19-year-old Brianne Walgrum picked up the phone and dialed her close friend. The two made plans to get together around 11:15 at night on September 5th, 1998. Brianne got into her prized Acura Integra and drove away from her family home. She never arrived to pick up her friend, and she never came home. Witnesses spotted Brianne at a local 7-Eleven in the company of three unidentified women. That was the last confirmed sighting of Brianne, and to this day, the identities of those three women remain unknown. 5 days later, Brianne's car was found abandoned in a ditch along a side seldom-traveled logging road in the middle of a densely forested area. Despite exhaustive searches, no trace beyond that could be found. For more than two decades, the Walgrum family, friends, and the city of Revelstoke, British Columbia have tried to solve this horrifying mystery. How does a young woman drive into her small town and vanish into thin air? Who were the three women, and what secrets might they possess? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 104, The Disappearance of Brianne Walgrum. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the truly mystifying disappearance of 19-year-old Brianne Walgrum. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders, disappearances, and other crimes. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence Podcast. The show is also on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show, as it is a one-man operation, and you'd like to get some Trace Evidence swag, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information, as well as thorough information on all episodes. To submit case suggestions, you can visit the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 19-year-old Brianne Walgrum left home to pick up a friend and never arrived. For 22 years, her disappearance has frustrated friends, family, and investigators. This is episode 104, The Disappearance of Brianne Walgrum. Revelstoke is a small and quiet city located in the southeast corner of British Columbia, Canada. Set within the Columbia Mountains, Revelstoke sits just over 600 kilometers or 372 miles east of Vancouver, and 400 kilometers or 248 miles west of Calgary. It's not a large city, just under 8,000 residents living in a 40 square kilometer area, comparable to the size of cities like Alexandria, Virginia, and Bridgeport, Connecticut. The official website for Revelstoke describes the city as being isolated compared to other cities in British Columbia, due in part to its location in the mountains. However, what Revelstoke lacks in populace and ease of access, it more than makes up for in scenic beauty and natural wonders. There are a vast array of outdoor activities to be enjoyed, including golf, skiing, and river rafting. Two national parks, Glacier and Mount Revelstoke, offer hiking, mountain biking trails, and during the cold season, guided snowmobile tours. It's truly a beautiful area. And while its small population and secluded location would seemingly offer up that quaint hometown feel, there is a dark mystery that lingers over the town and its residents, one which has eluded answers and baffled locals, law enforcement, and reporters alike for the past 22 years. On September 5, 1998, 19-year-old Brianne Walgrum vanished while in the company of three women who, to this day, remain unidentified. How is it possible for someone to disappear without a trace from such a small town, where almost everyone knows everyone else, through one measure or another? That is a question which has haunted those who investigate this case for more than two decades, and while her story is tragic and upsetting, there are few clues available to try and begin piecing this puzzle together. Brianne Ruth Walgrum was born on March 25, 1979, to parents Cheryl and Cliff. At the time of her birth, the Walgrums had two sons, Troy and Todd, making Brianne the baby of the family. According to the official website, findbrianne.wordpress.com, Brianne could be somewhat shy and withdrawn at first, but after she warmed up and let someone in, she was kind and caring, a young woman with an interest in fun and laughter. The website describes her saying, quote, "Those who were lucky enough to get to know her would say she was outgoing, fun, and absolutely hilarious," end quote. Not a great amount of detail about Brianne's upbringing is available, but that which is seems to paint the portrait of a sweet young woman with dreams not so different from your own. She wanted to travel, see the world beyond the borders of Canada. She wanted to attend college with a goal of becoming a pharmacist assistant, to map out a future for herself, and someday marry and have children. She longed to share the love that bloomed inside of her, and those who knew her felt that love whenever they were in her presence. She was a good student, bright and attentive, and according to the website, lived an active lifestyle, playing sports up to and through high school, while also working out at the gym to keep herself in shape. Considering the area in which she was raised, physical fitness would almost be a requisite for going on adventures through the mountains and forests. And whether it was due to a desire to have fun, a conscious effort to keep herself moving, or some combination of both, Brianne worked hard to maintain herself and stay fit. As she got older, Brianne indulged in some typical teenage behavior, drinking at parties and having a good time, though her family states that while she enjoyed a good time, she wasn't a drug user, nor did she get herself into trouble throughout her life. She was, for the most part, what you would imagine for the typical teenager. Brianne had a wide assortment of friends that she made through school, extracurricular activities, and through her older brothers. I get the impression that she was extremely likable and thus was able to make friends rather quickly once she got over her initial shyness. The website goes on to explain that while Brianne did not have a boyfriend at the time of her disappearance, there were several people that she had crushes on, though these individuals are not named. At 19, Brianne lived at home with her parents while her older brothers had since moved out. In her post-high school life, in hopes of building up money to fulfill some of her dreams, Brianne continued to live up her life as a dedicated worker and focused student. She managed to balance two jobs while also maintaining time with her family and, of course, her social circle of close friends. Her first job was at a local McDonald's fast food restaurant, located at 1800 Trans-Canada Highway in Revelstoke. She also worked at the Old Frontier Super Save gas station at 122 North Highway 23, just a 10-minute drive along the Trans-Canada Highway, one exit northeast of the Victoria Road interchange. The close proximity of both jobs made it easier to work two shifts in a single day, though this sometimes led to Brianne being tired from one night shift to an opening shift. According to an article in The Province, a British Columbia newspaper, approximately 4 months before Brianne disappeared, her grandfather passed away. When her grandfather's will was executed, Brianne, along with other members of the family, received some money, and Brianne knew exactly what she was going to do with hers. In May of 1998, the 19-year-old purchased a 1989 black Acura Integra with gold-colored rims and the license plate GMN661. Brianne's website defines this car as her pride and joy, something she truly treasured and was grateful to have been able to purchase. This would surely make her bounce between the gas station and McDonald's a lot easier and a lot more stylish as well. I'm sure we all remember the excitement of finally getting that first car that you've always wanted. Sadly, in Brianne's case, she wouldn't get to enjoy that car for very long. On the evening of Friday, September 4th, Brianne worked a closing shift at McDonald's and afterwards went out to have some fun with her friends. When she got up for work the next day, Saturday, September 5th, the day she would disappear, she was tired from a late night but made her way to work regardless. Brianne, though, did not seem to be herself that day beyond her tiredness. According to several of her coworkers, Brianne was more quiet than usual. It seemed as though something was bothering her, but whatever it was, she never told anyone. It was enough, however, that her demeanor was noted, and considering that what would happen later that night, many have wondered if there could be a connection between her mood and her later disappearance. In the afternoon, while working her shift, Brianne broke down crying. Cheryl later told the province, quote, "She had a little cry, and then she got over it. They told her she could go home, but she wanted to keep working," end quote. Investigator Rhonda Morgan later told the Calgary Herald, quote, "According to all of her friends and workmates at the Super Save gas station in Revelstoke, she was off, as they put it," end quote. Brianne's shift ended at approximately 6:30 that evening, and she arrived back at her parents' home around 7 p.m. According to Cheryl, Brianne looked tired and told her she was going to take a nap. The Walgram family had been invited to a barbecue that night, but Brianne decided not to go along, wanting to catch up on her sleep. Around 9 p.m., Brianne picked up her phone and called her close friend, Christy Kane. Kane and Brianne became friends in third grade, and over the years, their friendship had only grown stronger. The two spoke on the phone almost every night. According to Kane, the two made plans to get together. Kane was working until 11:15 p.m., and Brianne offered to pick her up so they could spend some time chilling with their friends. Brianne would never arrive, though, and Kane called her house at approximately 11:20, but no one was home. Kane continued to wait before finally catching another ride. It was strange for Brianne to not show up without a call or an explanation. She was a very dependable woman who wasn't known to flake out. When asked about this later, Kane replied, quote, "She's my best friend. If she wasn't going to make it to pick me up, she would have called," end quote. Cheryl later confirmed this, explaining, quote, "When Brianne said she was going to do something, she does it," end quote. After not hearing from Brianne and none of her friends seeing her that night, Kane finally got scared and called her house at approximately 3:30 a.m., waking Cheryl with the phone call that is every parent's nightmare. When Cheryl found out that Brianne hadn't arrived to pick Kane up and that no one had seen her since, she immediately got into her car and began driving around town looking for that black Acura Integra with the gold rims, but she didn't see it or Brianne anywhere. When Brianne couldn't be located and no one seemed to know where she could be, her parents contacted the police to report her missing. While at the time, the report wasn't exactly taken as seriously as her family had hoped, it would slowly grow into one of the most enduring and troubling missing persons cases in the area, involving local police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and even investigators from the Calgary Police Service's Homicide Unit. The initial investigation involved visiting Brianne's jobs, speaking with their friends, and showing her picture to people in the area wondering if they might have seen her the night she disappeared. There were several individuals who reported seeing either Brianne or her car that night. According to these interviews, a fairly bare-bones timeline has been established for the known comings and goings of Brianne that night. At some point that evening, perhaps killing time before she was supposed to pick up Kane, Brianne stopped by her job at Super Save and visited some co-workers she was friends with. One of those friends needed to grab some alcohol from a liquor store but wouldn't be out of work in time, and so Brianne ran the errand for her. The next sighting of Brianne came at approximately 11:30 p.m. Several witnesses reported seeing her, dressed in a white t-shirt, blue jeans, and black sandals, standing outside of a 7-Eleven convenience store. The 7-Eleven was located at 411 Victoria Road in Revelstoke, approximately 2.3 kilometers or 1.4 miles south of the gas station where she had been earlier. It was a short 4-minute drive, and assuming that Brianne didn't go anywhere else first, it's believed she may have left the gas station around 11:15 or 11:20. The witnesses who spotted Brianne at the 7-Eleven that night reported that she wasn't alone, but instead was in the company of three unidentified women. These women to this day remain unknown, and composite sketches of two of the three women were drawn up and distributed, though no one seemed to know them. To this day, none of the three women has ever come forward to explain their interactions with Brianne that night. Interestingly, when speaking to the Calgary Herald, investigator Morgan explained that while Revelstoke had a small population and there were few strangers who passed through town, The weekend that Brianne disappeared, there were a lot of strangers in town. Investigator Morgan stated, quote, "There was a big CP ball tournament in Revelstoke that weekend. There were a lot of strangers in town from all over, and we believe the three young women we are looking for may have been involved with that somehow." End quote. If you're not Canadian, and possibly even if you are, you may be asking yourself what I was. What is CP ball? Well, that wasn't an easy answer to find. I spoke with Kim Miller, a Canadian listener of the show, and she wasn't sure. I also asked Robin Warder of The Trail Went Cold, another Canadian, but he couldn't confirm. It may have referred to golf, soccer, or a game for those with physical disabilities. Either way, it's entirely possible that these three women could have been from out of town. Morgan also mentioned that Brianne had been in Calgary just the week before her disappearance, visiting universities with a friend. Another witness, though not the last, claimed that he was driving out of town that night and he was behind a black Acura Integra which fit the description of Brianne's car. According to this witness, the Acura was driving out of town and there was one driver and three passengers, perhaps the three women who had been with Brianne at the 7-Eleven that night. This was the last sighting of Brianne that night, but not the last overall. During their investigation, police weren't sure what to make of it. On the one hand, according to everyone they had spoken to, Brianne was not the type to just go off on her own or with people she didn't know, especially without telling someone, maybe her parents, maybe the friend she left waiting to be picked up that night. Much to the Walgrams' frustration, there were rumors that perhaps Brianne had decided to run away or may have planned to harm herself. Cheryl emphatically denies that, saying that Brianne would never leave and would never hurt herself. Nothing was missing from the home, none of Brianne's personal effects, and to this day, her bank account has remained untouched. Christy Kane agreed with Cheryl, telling reporters, quote, "Nothing makes sense. If something was going on, she would have told me. I hope she's alive. I'll never give up hope." End quote. Eventually, police would come around, agreeing that running away or self-harm were unlikely explanations for Brianne's disappearance. While they had nothing to indicate foul play, they didn't think this was a simple matter. Brianne would have called, left a note, even if she did run away, she wouldn't let her friends or family worry about her. RCMP Sergeant Arthur Kleinsmith told the province, quote, "This girl had no reason to run away from anything. She had nothing but her life ahead of her." End quote. 5 long days would pass with Brianne's family working desperately to try and locate her. Investigators continued asking questions but had little to work with, much to the family's frustration. They felt police could be doing more, and they weren't about to sit around and wait. They produced flyers, handed them out everywhere in town and the surrounding area. People joined in, friends, locals, people who didn't even know Brianne but wanted to help. They were looking for their daughter, their sister, their friend, and no one seemed to have any information. It was exceedingly disturbing, the idea that she could just disappear from this quiet town on a Saturday night, but no one knew anything about it. Finally, on Thursday, September 10th, Brianne's car was located, but it wasn't in town. It was in a remote area, and no one could understand how it ended up there. Approximately 28 kilometers or 17 miles south of Revelstoke is Kokolex Falls, a series of waterfalls in a gorge which pour down the Kokolex River into the Upper Arrow Lake. A hydroelectric facility is placed in that area, drawing power from the Frayne Falls, located upstream at the top of the gorge. A lot of unnamed logging roads exist in the area, one which is referred to by the Calgary Herald as Echo Lake Road. An RCMP air service spotted Brianne's Acura along this road and radioed about their sighting. Investigators began the treacherous drive along the twisting gravel mountain road and eventually came upon Brianne's car. The car was found partially in a ditch, having hit a tree at a sharp right angle bend in the road. The car sustained only minor damage, though it was clear that whoever had been driving it would have been unable to free it from the ditch without assistance. It's not a well-traveled road. It's likely not a road someone would know unless they lived in the area, had visited the falls before, or just happened to stumble upon it while driving through this very remote area. This location is approximately a 45-minute drive from Breanne's home. Cheryl later told the Province, quote, "I can't believe she was up on that road. There's nothing out there. It's almost like an alien came down and took her away," end quote. While sweeping through the vehicle, investigators found several items in the glove compartment which caused concern. There was more than $200 in cash. Breanne had cashed a paycheck the night she vanished, as well as Breanne's driver's license and bank card. This confounded investigators quite a bit as, had this been some kind of a robbery or perhaps even an abduction, why would the suspect or suspects leave the money behind? Perhaps to make it look like something else, perhaps they didn't check the glove box. I don't know about you, but I don't keep my license or my debit card in the glove box, so the fact that they were found there is pretty bizarre. Unless Breanne or someone else placed them there for a specific reason. In addition to the glove box items, Breanne's keys were still in the ignition, though the vehicle was turned off. I also read that a men's size 11 boot print was found in the mud near the car, though I could not find secondary sources to verify that claim or the claim that cigarette butts were found in Breanne's car, and reportedly, she was not a smoker. The car was very dusty and dirty, as I was told, which may have inhibited attempts to gather and process fingerprints. News of the car being found spread pretty quickly, and police were contacted by a man who had a strange experience just 2 days prior to the vehicle's discovery. A hunter who had been driving through the backwoods area told police that he had seen a woman along that very road. According to the witness, he saw a young woman who he described as a teenager walking on the road at approximately 8 a.m. on Sunday, September 6th, the day after Breanne vanished. This witness claimed that he had to steer around the young woman, with the road being rather thin, and that as he did, he waved and called out, "Hi," but the woman did not respond or even acknowledge his presence. One article by The Province said that the man was able to describe the woman's clothing, which had not at the time been made public. A later Province article, though, has the witness describing this woman as wearing shorts, so I'm not sure if that means his description of her clothing had not yet been made public or if Breanne's clothing hadn't been. It seems more likely to be the former, as missing persons flyers would surely have described her clothing. This raises an interesting question. Was the woman seen on the road that day Breanne, having changed her clothes? Or was it one of the three unidentified women she was last seen with? Discovery of Breanne's car kicked off a massive search that lasted several weeks. Searchers included law enforcement, family, friends, and local volunteers. Tracking dogs were able to pick up Breanne's scent in the car, but their trail dried up just 3 meters up the road. That's a very short trail, 3 meters being equal to around 9 feet. Beyond that, hundreds of people scoured the area. Boats went along rivers searching the shores for any sign of Breanne. Several planes and helicopters also searched from the sky, but again, there was no sign of Breanne. Considering that someone had been seen on the road 3 to 4 days before the search began, by the time searchers arrived, a lot of ground could have already been covered. In hopes of drumming up information about Breanne or the three women, a $20,000 reward was offered. No one has yet claimed it. I should note, this area near Kokolex Falls is densely wooded. There are a lot of rock formations, flowing water, and drop-offs. The gorge itself is quite vast and must have been extremely difficult to search on foot. I should also note that while most articles say the witness saw the woman walking along the road, at least one said that he had seen her walking up the mountain. I'll post some images of it on the website. It's certainly a formidable area to try and find someone. Sadly, Breanne's disappearance began growing cold shortly after the searches were concluded. For her family, it was devastating. Despite their desperation to find Breanne, her family and friends watched as days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. Over the years, the Walgrim family have spoken with the media, given interviews, anything they could do to keep Breanne's story in the public. Cheryl, at one time, considered the possibility that there may have been a reason the three women never came forward, and perhaps not a malicious one. Speaking with the Province, Cheryl said, quote, "Maybe Breanne went to a party with them. Maybe an accident happened. Maybe that's why they never came forward, because they're afraid. I just wish, if it was an accident, that the three people would come forward and let us know what happened. End quote. While the identity of the three women remains unknown, investigators have made public pleas for them to come forward, as their eyewitness accounts could play a vital role in discovering Brianne's whereabouts. The Missing Children's Society of Canada offered $10,000 for anyone who could identify the three women, but again, no one claimed that reward. There have been several fundraising events to try and increase the reward being offered, hoping for more information. A statue was erected in Woodenhead Park, called the Angel of Hope, commemorating Brianne's memory. Over the years, several instances of vandalism took place, including breaking the wings off. As a result of that, when the statue was repaired, a cage was placed over the statue to prevent future vandalism. I don't know what kind of person would vandalize a statue in memory of a missing person, but none of the words I have to describe those people would be rated PG. A GoFundMe created by Brianne's friend Anna Swayze is seeking money to offer as a reward is still active. If no reward is ever given, the money is set to be donated to the Missing Children's Society of Canada. They currently have just under $3,000 of a $20,000 goal. Anna told reporters, quote, "I worry people will forget. We need to keep attention on this. It should get people talking about it again, regardless if it's for good or bad." End quote. I don't believe anyone is going to forget Brianne, nor the search for her, and I hope this episode can help keep her case alive. I'm going to link to the GoFundMe in the show notes if you would like to contribute to their cause. Over the past two decades, multiple investigators have inherited and worked on Brianne's case, though it remains as mystifying to them as it was in 1998. In 2010, a group of investigators working for the Missing Children's Society of Canada went over the case, dug into the files, re-canvassed the area in hopes of gathering new information, but came to the same dead ends as law enforcement. Just last year, in April of 2019, Claudia Weitrull, an investigator with the RCMP, spoke with the Abbotsford News, saying, quote, "There's a lot of rumors. I'm very interested in this case. I want to find her and give closure to the family." End quote. Sadly, for the Walgrams, it's a nightmare that never ends. Cheryl thinks about her daughter every day and the circumstances surrounding her disappearance. Sometimes it can be overwhelming, with Cheryl saying, quote, "It's like a radio dial in my head. Sometimes I need to change the channel." End quote. Cheryl took up work as a maid in hopes of keeping herself distracted. But there is no escaping the harsh reality of the unknown. There are several theories about what may have happened to Brianne. Some believe that the three women seen with her that night must have been involved, or, at a minimum, have information that could help. The fact that they have never come forward does little to lend credence to their time with Brianne being merely happenstance. Others believe that Brianne may have fallen victim to a stranger, someone passing through town, perhaps for the tournament. Others still argue that in a town that small, with a shy young woman, it's more likely that someone she knew could have been responsible for her disappearance. Brianne Ruth Walgram is described as being a white female standing approximately 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing 130 pounds. At the time of her disappearance, Brianne had light brown, curly, shoulder-length hair, often worn tied back. She has blue eyes and a birthmark on the back of her right leg. She was last seen wearing a white t-shirt, blue jeans, and black sandals while in the company of three unidentified women. Brianne was last seen at the 7-Eleven in Revelstoke at approximately 11:30 p.m. on Saturday, September 5th, 1998. Those who knew and loved Brianne have never forgotten, nor have they ever given up. The city of Revelstoke remains covered in the shadow of this terrible mystery, a reminder of what has been lost forever, solidified in the statue of an angel. Brianne's father, Cliff, who has rarely spoken publicly, has made it clear that unless it can be proven to him that Brianne is deceased, he still believes his daughter is out there somewhere. If alive today, Brianne Walgram would be turning 41 years old next month on March 25th. Before her disappearance, One of Brienne's brothers gifted her an ornate candle-lit lantern shaped like a windmill. Every year, on her daughter's birthday, Cheryl lights the candle and places the lantern on the windowsill. When asked about why she does this, Cheryl replied, quote, "It's to light the way home." The disappearance of Brienne Walgrim is one of those cases that I can't believe doesn't get more attention. A young woman, smart, dependable, and shy, makes plans to get together with a friend and disappears. She's in the company of three other women who remain unidentified, and her car is later found on a desolate logging road in the middle of nowhere. There are cases less mysterious than this which are discussed constantly, and yet for this 19-year-old, it's almost as if no one outside of Revelstoke, or perhaps British Columbia, even knows about it. I'm sure that's not entirely the case, but to me, this is a terrible mystery that has stuck with me since the first day I read about it. Maybe it's the lack of evidence, maybe it's the witness accounts, maybe it's how much I empathize with her family, or maybe it's a combination of all three. I've covered a lot of missing persons cases, and this is one which truly sticks with me. I don't remember when I first learned about it, but ever since it's been in the back of my mind. I've wanted to do an episode on it for a while, but for whatever reason, I kept pushing it off. Finally, this week, it felt like the right time. Maybe with her 41st birthday coming next month, it really activated everything for me. Either way, this was a hard case to write. Aside from the lack of evidence, it's somewhat difficult to grasp. It really does feel like one of those gone without a trace cases. Most of the time, you've got something solid to work with, but here, you've got witnesses and a car and very little else. As you'd imagine, due to the lack of information, there's quite a few theories that have gained popularity over the years. We'll begin with what many people believe happened, that Brienne was preyed upon by a total stranger, either passing through town or visiting for the tournament. It's a frightening thing to imagine someone from outside of your community sweeping into town, committing a terrible crime, and vanishing as quickly as he or she came. We know there were a lot of people in town that weekend who weren't from the area, so in reality, you're dealing with a large list of potential suspects, most of whom you have no way to identify, short of someone coming forward with a tip or information that could finally make their name known to investigators. We know that Brienne was out on her own that night, other than the three women she was seen with, who we'll get into in a later theory. So we'd have to figure out, how did Brienne end up alone? We have the witnesses who saw the women, but we only have one witness who claims to have been behind Brienne's car and seen the three passengers. So, for the moment, let's imagine that somehow Brienne ended up alone. Maybe she dropped the women off somewhere, maybe they never got in the car in the first place. To deal with this theory directly requires a little bit of a stretch. We know that Brienne was shy, so the idea that a complete stranger would be able to talk her into giving a ride or maybe going along with him seems unlikely. Maybe, for the three women, it would have been easier as Brienne might have felt more comfortable with a group of women over a lone man or woman. So yeah, it's possible this guy could have talked her into something, pulled out a weapon, forced his way into her car. She could have stopped at a light, a stop sign, anything really. And this guy could have come running up and forced his way in. Sadly, that kind of thing happens a lot. In a small town like Revelstoke, it's unlikely that this guy is going to tell her to pull into a parking lot or go somewhere around town. There's people around. They're going to see something going on. Brienne had a very memorable car, especially with the gold rims, so this person would likely have wanted to get out of town, get to someplace more remote. We know that Brienne's car was found on that logging road. I previously said that this was a road that you'd either have to know was there or you'd have to stumble upon it. There's the possibility that this guy took control of the car and drove them there, knowing the location. Or maybe he started driving south towards the National Forest and saw a back road and took it. There's also the possibility that he could have been in the passenger seat and directed Brienne to drive him someplace in the middle of nowhere. If he had a weapon, was threatening, she may have been more likely to go along with it, especially if he promised her that he just wanted the car or he was going to leave her alone afterwards. It might not have been that malicious. Maybe this guy lied. Maybe he said that someone he had come with was hurt in the forest and he needed help. Of course, most people would bring him to the police or at least called them under those circumstances. However, Brianne didn't have a cell phone. Brianne was a kind-hearted person, and maybe this guy was urgent and insistent. Maybe he was really good at manipulation. Like so much of this case, it's hard to know. I could go on and on about the possible ways a person could have gotten Brianne under his or her control. The possibilities are quite broad when you look at it from all perspectives. So I suppose it's a matter of looking at the cons of this theory. The idea that Brianne's car was found where it was suggests to me a handful of possibilities. Either this person had a vehicle waiting in the area and drove off in it, possibly taking Brianne with him, or maybe this person wasn't working alone and someone was there waiting for them. Or maybe this person led Brianne up into the mountains and emerged later after doing whatever may have been done there. The road is a long walk back to society, so it seems a bit unlikely that this person did the latter part, taking her up into the mountains on foot, without a vehicle somewhere. I could see this person having a car waiting or having someone waiting for him. There's also the possibility that, if working with another person or persons, one of them could have driven Brianne's car onto that logging road while someone else followed, giving them a ride after they abandoned the car. I think the positioning of the car is important to note. This wasn't like someone just drove it into a ditch and left it there. The car was found at a sharp, right-angle turn in the road, down in a ditch having hit a tree. If someone were driving fast through the area and was unaware of the sharp turn, it wouldn't have been hard to slide off the gravel road and hit the tree in the process. From what I understand, no blood was found, and the damage to the car was minimal, so maybe it seems less likely that the driver was speeding. I mean, how fast can you really go around a 90-degree turn? I guess maybe that's why you crash. So, I can't imagine someone walking out of that area without their own car or someone else waiting for them. There's essentially one community within this area where Brianne's car was found. There's Greenslide, located 16 kilometers or 9.9 miles to the northwest of where Brianne's car was located. There's a handful of others, Camborne, Arrowhead, but the paths through the mountains don't seem to grant access to them. Google Maps constantly redirects the path north, around to the other side of the river, and then south and finally east. The other cities are certainly areas you could drive to. If you lived in one of them, you might know that logging road, or at least the area of it, but that seems to rule out the possibility of this person walking away from the car. I find it hard to believe that this crime could have been committed by a random stranger, if it was a stranger. It seems more likely that it would have to have been someone familiar with that general area, or perhaps someone who worked in the logging business. Knowing that it was such a remote logging road, it's not outside the realm of possibility that this could have been someone who worked in the area at that time or who had previously worked in the area. There's too much to try and analyze when it comes to the how in terms of getting Brianne's car to that location. Suffice it to say, I do think it's possible this crime could have been committed by a stranger, but I don't think that includes someone just passing through or visiting without some knowledge or experience in that area. So, if it wasn't a total stranger, what about the possibility that this could have been someone Brianne knew? Much like the stranger situation, this is a possibility that exists where we don't have a ton to work with. However, considering that Brianne was a somewhat shy young woman living in a small town, it does feel like there may be more of a possibility that she could have been abducted by someone she may have known. It certainly would have made it easier for the person committing the crime, at least. We don't know a lot about the people Brianne knew, though it's safe to assume that investigators questioned everyone who may have even just had a conversation with her. At least, everyone they knew about. However, Brianne worked two public-facing jobs, both of which were along a stretch of the Trans-Canada Highway. The highway runs east to west over 7,821 kilometers or 4,860 miles. Both of Brianne's jobs were near interchanges, and oftentimes travelers passing through on that highway might have been inclined to stop at a McDonald's or needed to pull off and get gas. Brianne could have interacted with a lot of different people who passed through on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. It isn't difficult to imagine that one of those people could have taken an unwanted or even unknown interest in her. We know that the night she disappeared, she'd been visiting friends at the gas station. Is it so hard to imagine that someone who knew she worked there could have gone by to see her and instead ended up following her or maybe speaking with her somewhere along the way? Now, this wouldn't necessarily be someone Brianne knew directly, at least not in the way we usually mean it, but it certainly could have been someone she spoke with or interacted with in the past, possibly at work. If that person knew the area well enough, passed through frequently enough, then they may have been aware of the logging roads in the area. As mentioned previously, it could have been someone who even worked on those logging roads. The fact that Brianne was upset the day that she vanished and seemed off makes me lean towards her possibly knowing her abductor. Sure, it could just be a red herring, but why wouldn't she tell any of her friends about why she was upset? If it was just some creepy dude who passed through, that's not so hard to explain. However, if it's someone you know, someone your friends might know, maybe you don't want to air that dirty laundry publicly. But I digress. From the gas station to the location where Brianne's car was found was approximately a 45-minute drive. Once you get south of Revelstoke Airport, it's a drive south along the river, passing through the area of Greenslide, and then turning east into the mountains. Basically, once you're south of the airport, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere, heading further and further away from any signs of life. So why would the person, if they were not local to the area, drive south instead of hopping on the highway and heading either east or west? It would be faster, and considering the time of night, it's unlikely that there would have been a lot of traffic. It seems more likely that whoever was involved in Brianne's disappearance knew that desolate stretch of road was there, and whether it was planned to be that way or was a matter of circumstance, I find it difficult to believe anybody just stumbled upon that logging road. However, I also don't know that Brianne was even on that logging road. Someone could have easily abducted her, placed her somewhere, or perhaps done worse, and then driven her car out to that location, maybe planning to drive it into the water, maybe planning to take it somewhere else, and then the accident happened. We know that tracking dogs picked up Brianne's scent, but it barely went beyond the car. To me, that could either indicate that while her scent was in the car, she wasn't actually there that night, or the trail was so short because it was Brianne moving from one car to another waiting car. I still think it's incredibly unlikely that anyone could have walked their way out of there without being noticed. It would have taken quite a while. According to Google, it would take the average person approximately 17 hours to walk from the location of Brianne's car to Greenslide. According to Google Maps, that particular logging road has no major exit, meaning that the way in is the same way out. If the maps are accurate, then not far past where the car was found, the road splits. One path heading northeast, the other southeast. Both of these paths dead end, with the southeastern path stopping in the vicinity of McRae Peak. The northern branch stops just east of Mount Kenneth. There's a few paths that drift off the road, but again, none of them lead to any major roadways or any roads at all. Now, on the other hand, the logging road runs perpendicular to the river, 9.24 kilometers or 5.7 miles southwest of the location where the car was found, is a place where the river can be crossed with relative ease. The total width of the river in that spot is approximately 500 meters or 1,650 feet. Whether or not there's a little bridge there that you can walk across, I don't know. You might have to raft or swim, but that distance is certainly doable. Just another 3.7 kilometers or 2.3 miles north is Blanket Creek Provincial Park, which is seated along Highway 23. In total, from the car to the park is 14 kilometers or 9 miles. Now, that's a walking time of approximately 3.5 hours, which certainly seems more doable than the 17 hours to Greenslide. If this person was alone or didn't have a vehicle waiting on the logging road, it's conceivable that he could have abandoned the car in that spot and walked back. The car wasn't found until 5 days after Brianne disappeared, so that time is available. But what about the hunter? He spotted a young woman walking near the car the day after Brianne disappeared. That makes little sense to me unless we're considering the possibility that Brianne and her car were elsewhere for that day. It seems unlikely someone would have crashed the car knowing it was stolen or belonged to a missing woman and would still be walking not too far from it a day later. And we're not talking about someone who was spotted several miles from the car. This was someone who was spotted pretty close to the car, probably could actually see the car from where they were, depending on the curve in the road. If Brianne was held somewhere else or taken, if her car was held somewhere for a day or several hours, then it would have to be someone nearby. Otherwise, why would they have abandoned the car on that logging road instead of somewhere further away? It's my belief that the car wasn't supposed to be left where it was. There may have been a plan to dump it somewhere further up into the mountains where it was much less likely to be found. Maybe to even push it off one of the cliff bases in that area down into the densely wooded area below. If it was kept nearby, then it had to be someone in the area who knew that area, had a place to stay, or at least had a place to conceal the car. This is all under the assumption that the hunter's statement was accurate. Quickly, before moving on to the final theory, I do want to address an angle of this that almost everyone associated with the case has dismissed. Some have argued that it may have been Brianne herself that drove the car there, that the woman seen by the hunter could have been Brianne walking down the road or up the mountain. No one believes that Brianne would have left of her own volition. I don't think it's possible for her to have been driving through, crashed her car, and then been looking for help, though. She would have waved to the hunter. She would have flagged him down if that's what happened. Considering that he says he waved at her and she ignored him, this doesn't sound like someone looking for help. We also have to consider that the woman was wearing different clothes from what Brianne was last seen wearing, and it doesn't sound like they found those clothes in the car, the ones that she had previously been wearing. So if Brianne did change, she'd had to have done it somewhere else. Yet no one has ever come forward about that. Then again, no one has ever come forward about much of anything in this case. Personally, I don't think the woman seen on the logging road that day was Brianne, but I have no explanation for who it could have been. If it was one of the three women, where were the other two? Maybe off the road and into the mountains, maybe outside of the hunter's view, maybe they left her behind driving away in a different vehicle. What we know is that whoever it was has never come forward. It's difficult for me to believe that anyone in that area wouldn't have known about Brianne being missing. It's hard for me to imagine anyone who saw that car wouldn't have reported it unless they had something to hide. If indeed a boot print was found in the mud, though I can't verify that, then it seems to suggest that more than one person was there since it was a male boot. I mean, I suppose a woman could have been wearing a man's boots. It seems unlikely that the car, though, would have crashed just near a boot print purely by happenstance. But again, we just don't know. So we'll move into the final angle of this case, the three unidentified women. I find it very suspicious that these three women have never come forward. If you live in Canada, if you're in British Columbia, if you've been through Revelstoke, there's no way you don't know about this case. How likely is it that they never heard about it? How likely is it that if they did hear about it, they didn't realize the missing girl was the one they were talking to? On the list of all possibilities, those all seem pretty slim to me. No, these women have to know more than we're aware of. Even if they were just able to fill in some blanks that night, it would be more information than we have now. So why haven't they ever come forward? Cheryl thought there was the possibility of an accident, and sure, that could be. Maybe they partied with Brianne, maybe something went wrong. But then, why abandon the car in the middle of nowhere? Being that no one knew who they were, it's not like anyone was going to be looking for them, and given the history of this case, no one can find them either. So, these three women were seen talking to Brianne outside of a 7-Eleven. We have a witness who says he drove behind Brianne's car and there were three passengers. He defined their direction as heading out of town. However, if Brianne did have these three women in the car with her, how'd they originally get to the 7-Eleven? It seems unlikely that they drove there and left their car behind, so what if someone else drove them there? I don't know that the three women are responsible for what happened, but there's certainly the possibility. Maybe a robbery gone wrong. Maybe it was just supposed to be a ride somewhere and things went sideways. The possibilities are somewhat endless. There is, of course, the possibility that these women were working with someone else. As I mentioned in the episode earlier, a young woman is more likely to go along with a few smiling female faces than she is to go along with a lone man or a group of men. This is a tactic often employed by human traffickers, using women to trap and capture other women. Revelstoke is approximately 294 kilometers or 182 miles north of the U.S. border. That's a three-hour drive south. Then you're in another country, and we know that human traffickers don't worry much about border crossings. They have their ways around it. And while the southern border of the United States is an oft-debated and controversial topic, the northern border isn't paid all that much attention to. I mean, you can't just walk through, but I doubt it's as hard to get through. To me, it's entirely possible that Brienne was trafficked, which, while horrifying, could leave the possibility that she may still be alive, though what she has endured for 20 years I can't imagine. While I admit that possibility is slim, it is a possibility nonetheless. So, what about the car and the woman seen 2 days later? Honestly, this is the part of the case that baffles me the most. Maybe she was supposed to drive that car to a rendezvous location and crashed instead. Maybe she started walking up the road to get where she was supposed to be, and when whoever she was working with found out that she crashed the car, they hauled ass and all got out of there. Maybe, maybe, maybe. Everything is a maybe in this case. To have not been involved in some crime against Brienne, and then to have been spotted near her car just a day later, is a coincidence I find extremely difficult to swallow. Maybe those women didn't have anything to do with her disappearance. Maybe this was a different woman. But were that the case, why wouldn't they have come forward by now? It's been 22 years, and not even so much as an anonymous phone call to grant closure to a family that's been racked with horror and grief. That's one way to clean the slate, one way to explain the situation, one way to make law enforcement understand. For one or all of those women to come forward. If they were around Brienne's age, then they'd be in their early 40s today. If they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, if they're innocent of any crime, then they could possess information vital to the resolution of this case. Maybe they'll hear this episode one day. Maybe they'll start looking up the case one day. Maybe they'll just have a conscience. The mysterious disappearance of Brienne Walgrim is horrifying and without answers. A caring family, a loving daughter, a small town, and a whole lot of questions. Investigators have worked this case for 22 years but continue to hit roadblocks. Her family has sought the truth for just as long, plastered Canada with posters of Brienne, done interviews with every media outlet that gave them the time. 22 years is far too long to go without an answer. 19 years old is far too young to have the rest of your life taken away. Unfortunately, unless new evidence is found, someone comes forward with the right tip, or those three women appear to tell their story, the disappearance of Brienne Walgrim will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for information about the disappearance of Brienne Walgrim, there are several newspaper articles and online forum posts discussing her case. A friend of the family runs the site findbrienne.wordpress.com, which has a lot of vital information about Brienne and her disappearance. If you would like to contribute to the reward efforts for information regarding Brienne's disappearance, there is a GoFundMe set up that you can donate to. I'm going to link to that GoFundMe in the show notes, and I'm also going to put it on the website. You can also just go to GoFundMe.com and search for Brienne Walgrim. If you have any information about the disappearance of Brienne Walgrim, you can contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. You can do so completely anonymously. You can also go to the findbrienne.wordpress.com website and submit anonymous tips there. You can also contact the Revelstoke RCMP at 250-837-5255 or the Missing Children's Society of Canada at 1-800-661-6160. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, tag me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to give you guys a quick scheduling update before I end the show. Next week on Tuesday, February 18th, there will not be an episode. I'm actually going to be going out of town for something that I hope to be able to tell you about pretty soon because it's exciting for me. So Trace Evidence will return on Tuesday, February 25th. One final note. Are you planning to attend CrimeCon this year in Orlando? If you are and you haven't yet purchased your ticket, you can use the promo code TRACE2020 to get 10% off today. I'm going to be there on Podcast Row representing Trace Evidence, and I would love to see you there. So when purchasing your tickets, use promo code TRACE2020, and I look forward to seeing you. It's time to thank our Patreon producers. Special shout out to Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Angie Dodd, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Roberta Jansen, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Brett Eady, Kevin Bonham, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Gerard Lopez Barbosa, Jessica, Laura Dickinson, Linda Halcrow, Nick Mohar Schurz, Megan Cotter, Quinn McBreen, Randy Weiland, Robbie Blue, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. If you think your name should be on this list but it's not, please contact me as Patreon is often terrible at organizing the lists properly. That's going to do it for this episode. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.